Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Candace Fleming and Eric Roman, author and illustrator team, wife and husband team, storytelling team. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 305 of the podcast with Candace Fleming and Eric Roman. But before I share that with you, here are a couple of lovely words you left on iTunes from Tacit Knowledge. I'm a reading specialist and work with children who typically dislike reading. Amen to that, Tacit Knowledge. This podcast gives me all kinds of information about books to recommend to my students. I can listen on my way to school and on my way home. It's a great resource. I am grateful that you find it a great resource. Thank you so much for listening, for supporting your children, for supporting the people that I have on this podcast by getting their books. That is awesome. I'm glad it's a resource for you. And the other review that I got in that I want to share with you is from Mama Fox. Books. Mama Fox Books, who writes, Matthew Winner, after listening to your podcast for several months now, I feel like I know you. You probably do know me. I tend to wear my heart on my sleeve. Anyway, maybe our paths will cross in real life someday. I'm a children's librarian turned author, and lucky me, I have most certainly stumbled upon a pot of gold with all the wonders. I am learning so much from you and your guests, and I smile every time I hear the name of an author or publisher whose books I have loved and shared with children for years. Thank you for helping me feel closer to those I admire. Your enthusiasm and passion for the craft of making children's books is inspiring. Ah, Mama Fox Books, you're so nice. Yeah, I'm always happy to be enthusiastic when it comes to sharing good books, and it makes me even more enthusiastic to know that the episodes are connecting with you and that you're sharing with others. That is amazing. Thank you. Blows my mind always to find out that people listen to this podcast, that it reaches that way. That's amazing. So listen, you know the drill. These reviews help the podcast reach new ears, and I thank you for taking the time to write them. It means so much to me, and it helps so much. Therefore, you write a review, and as thanks, I'm going to send you an All the Wonders smiley face button. I've already mailed a bunch out. All you need to do to get your own is go onto iTunes and post a comment or rate the podcast. And then email me at here@allthewonders.com, H-E-R-E at allthewonders.com, and let me know. Include your mailing address, and I'll send you a button anywhere within the U.S. And if you don't live in the U.S., email me, and I'll send you a personalized video message. Okay, so time for today's awesomeness. Candy and Eric have a lot of good stuff going for them. Candy is an accomplished author of picture books, both fiction and nonfiction, and novels. Eric is the 2-time recipient of the Caldecott Medal and has made many, many beautiful picture books. And by some amazing timing, they are responsible for 2 of the books published under Neil Porter's imprint this year. We talk about both Giant Squid and Presenting Buffalo Bill. And I share no shortage of enthusiasm for these exceptional works. But what I'm most excited about is the enthusiasm you and your readers will also share after you read them. I just know it. Here's episode number 305 of the podcast with Candace Fleming and Eric Roman. Welcome to the podcast. Candace Fleming, Eric Roman, I'm beside myself getting to talk to you tonight. Thank you for making time to talk.
Thanks. We're glad to be here.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Oh man, let me tell you about book mail. Do you get book mail as authors and illustrators?
No.
I mean, you get your books when they come, right? Like they give you the advanced copies, all of that.
Oh, but, yeah, but sure.
As a librarian and as a reviewer, I get surprise mail. Just every once in a while, stuff shows up on my doorstep and I'm like, oh, what's in this manila package? And when I opened it and a giant squid was looking me in the eye, that was amazing. So congratulations on your brand new picture book together, Giant Squid. I can't wait to talk about it. It's a book that I fell hard for right away.
Oh, we really appreciate that. Thank you.
So you've got this wonderful book where we, the reader, get to be the scientist asking the questions alongside your beautiful poetic text, Candy. And Eric, the way that you just tease out glimpses of this squid, I want to give you the honor of sharing with the listening audience what Giant Squid, what the story is, what's your book talk for the book, and then I want to dive in asking you all about it, if that's okay. Would you mind sharing?
And I'll start by just saying that you said when you pulled it out, it was kind of a surprise. And in some ways, it was a surprise for us, too. I was at a conference in 2008 and sat down with an editor, a friend of mine, in fact, Neil Porter's boss, and just on a little napkin, I had this idea for a book about giant squid. And what I did, what's unusual about it, is that I had made a storyboard for it with some idea what the text might be. But I had basically a finished storyboard, and I thought, I'm not landing on the text here. It feels big. And I thought, you know, what do I know about nonfiction? And then, as I should have at the beginning, I thought, you know, I have, you know, one of the best nonfiction writers for children who's 20 feet away from me right now. And so I gave her the storyboard and I said, write something. And she wrote something. And
talk about being completely opposite from any picture book I've written before, right?
Oh, sure, right?
Typically, you write the text and you give it to the illustrator and he or she interprets it. But here I had all these storyboards and I had to figure out how to weave a text into those illustrations, which actually turned out to be a lot of fun for me because for the very first and maybe the only time in my writing life, I actually got to tell the illustrator to, move a few pictures around, take a few pictures out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a huge amount of editing. I mean, my original idea had it started with the mythology of squid.
Oh, yeah.
So the thrust of the idea was always the same, and that's that this is a creature that there's hundreds of thousands of them, maybe even millions in the deep ocean, and we've hardly seen any of them. It's been, you know, the mythology, of course, has been that it's this dangerous creature that attacks individuals and boats.
The Jersey Shore.
Yeah, all that sort of thing. And I wanted to include all that. Well, what Candy saw was those pictures, I think, that are bits of the squid.
Yes.
And then when she started doing research, she saw that that's kind of the way that the squid was discovered. They'd find an eye or a half of a tentacle or something like that. And so it made perfect sense to give it over to her, gave it back to me. I changed some things, gave it back to her. She changed some things. And so over a period of time, we had that give and take and got what you see today.
I love the way you accomplished this. And Candy, it makes me so excited to hear that you actually worked from storyboards, because yes, that seems like such a rare and unusual opportunity, but also, go ahead.
Yeah, it was. It was just, it was a real interesting way to work, a real new way. So, and I was like a challenge. So, you know, it was a lot of fun. But what were you going to say, Matt?
I was going to say the way you accomplished this book together, to me, feels like, here's the way I experienced this book, and this was right away when my son and I read it. It felt like you dropped, you know, in some deep water submersible, there there was a camera that had like a movement sensor. And in the beginning, it feels like whenever that squid swam past the camera, the camera would flash and we would just get a glimpse of something, just a piece of a tentacle, just the you know, a shot of its beak. And so going through this book, the way that the squid, if I can talk about it as if it's a living, breathing character, which I feel like it is in this book, the way that it just sort of plays in front of the camera for the reader as your words sort of
coax it out.
Yeah.
And I think in good fiction, who a character is reveals itself slowly through their actions.
Yes.
And obviously from the art angle, you know, how do I show something that lives in a lightless place? And of course, we had looked at a few of the videos. There's only three, actually, of real giant squid. And that's why you see the light playing on the creature that way, is I wanted to give you the sense. And the way I got that, of course, is when Candy started writing about going down deep.
Oh,
into
the sea.
That immediately puts you in a submersible, you know, you're going down there in this alien place.
May I read to you? Would you mind if I read the beginning text of your book?
I would love that. I've never heard anyone read it.
To have the entrance, to give context to the listeners, you have this, I believe it's a three, you have three spreads before we even get to the title. The title page is the third spread.
It's buried, isn't it? It's very cool. It's cinematic, like you said.
It is, exactly. We have an opening scene, if you will, before the title appears onto the screen. It's just wonderful. So it goes, down, down in the depths of the sunless sea, deep, deep in the cold, cold dark, creatures strange and fearsome lurk. With writhing arms and ghostly, lidless eyes, they glide. Some large as buses, some weighing a ton, so big yet rarely seen. Instead, they are merely glimpsed now and then from the prow of a ship, from a rocky seashore, through the lens of an underwater camera. Who are these giants of the dark seas? How do they hunt? How do they eat? How do they breed? It is a mystery.
And that is the main thrust of the both the visual and the written storytelling is how do we engage our reader? How do we fascinate them immediately? And that's the reason why we eventually decided the title page was best later, because we wanted to submerge them and involve them in that place right away without any front matter or our names or publishers.
Yeah, it was just, it felt just like clutter. It felt like, you know, here we'd both worked so hard to, like, as you said, drop your reader right into the ocean. And then we had this clutter, it just pulled them right out. And so, you know, I remember when we suggested to Neil that we really thought the title page should not come until the text actually uses the words giant squid. And he was really readily willing to do that.
Yeah.
You know, he saw it as soon as we said it, he saw it.
Yeah.
So he was actually here when we...
Yeah.
He'd come.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So he literally saw it.
I will tell you, there was the book began in 2008, and I had other things going. Oh No was one of them.
Oh yeah.
And then I started the book, and I had some technical problems with the printing process, and I thought this is just too much trouble, and I kind of put it to the side. And then Neil called and said, you know, are you still working on the squid book? No, he said I think you should. So I started up again. Had more troubles. Was really frustrated with it, and he came out, and that's when he looked at the storyboard and the drawings I had made,
and
that's
when I read it out loud to him while Eric shuffled his paintings, and
in fact Neil, well, you know, when Candy suggested to him that she was gonna write this nonfiction prose poem, which those don't go together that often. I think he was a little skeptical at first, but he said what the first time you read it, that, and I'm paraphrasing, that he didn't know we wanted this, but once he read it, he knew it was the exact right thing.
Well, even in the design, just down to on that very first page, that the text is white against a dark, dark blue background. Like it's as close to black, I feel like, as it could be. And it just feels like bubbles coming up from the depths or something like that. It's just,
and if you look at the manuscript, Candy actually, that, you know, those indentations and everything, you know, were in the original manuscript. You know, we played, especially with that first page, we played a little bit to make it sort of move down toward where the squid's arm and tentacle is.
But
for the most part, if you look at the manuscript, it looks pretty much the same as it does in the book.
So how did you then do the art on this book? You said you're having a hard time with the process. You said that it was...
I was doing it. It's just a printmaking medium. It's called monotype. And it's a way of making a single print. And I was using multiple layers of color to get that deep, you know, that sort of really deep color. And I was, the ink, layers of ink were rejecting. And you know, I'm sort of connected in the printmaking world, and I know lots of experts, and they couldn't figure it out either. And eventually, when Neil came, he said, you know, you only have 4 months left to finish this. And so that's when I, you know, stretched some paper made oil paintings.
Did oil paintings? Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, the richness that oil gave way to is just—it's beautiful. I keep staring at.
It was a really good thing to fall back on.
Yeah. The fade in the light, that in the beginning we just get that slight glimmer of light. It's just it's haunting. It's beautiful.
Here's the great thing about oil paint is that I can draw and paint a squid, a tentacle or a beak or something in just regular light. And then by using transparent layers, they're called glazes in oil painting, on top of a neutral color, it starts to read as if it's underwater, as if I'm layering these, you know, there's multiple layers. So actually it is behind a liquid.
And on a selfish level, I preferred the oil paintings because when he was struggling so badly with the monoprints, his printing studio is directly below my office. And I knew he was having really bad days by the explosiveness that would come up through my floor. And I thought, I have to work at the library today. So once he started painting, things were really quiet.
Wow, I tell you how great your text is, and you tell me.
Well, I was going to say how lucky you were, Eric, that you married into strong nonfiction background. But yeah, you can also see what a knack she has for telling the truth.
Yes, exactly. Sorry, that kind of caught me off guard there. Usually I have some response, but... not this time. I believe this interview is over.
Candy, did the text come easy for you, or was it something that you struggled with? Because I love the way that, as I said in the beginning, it does feel like you're calling the reader to be a scientist, to ask questions, to say, let's put together these pieces. Because, you know, Eric in the layout doesn't reveal the full squid, the full body, until near the end. We see glimpses of what the full body might look like when we see the baby squid, but to see the baby giant squid. This is one of those.
Yeah, that's so weird, the baby giant.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's a big difference between, you know, the size, and that was another consideration is, yes, we could reveal it a little, but the big reveal, of course, had to somehow reflect the size. But you asked if it was...
When I started, I knew, you know, I have real definite opinions about nonfiction. I also discover I have really definite opinions about what picture books should be. And I think this is really the first time that I've written a true piece of nonfiction that's a picture book. I've written historical fiction, but, and I've never written science before. And I had definite opinions, you know, about how I felt about science picture books. And I really wanted to create something. I mean, I thought about it. I really wanted to create something that was had real readability, something that was a real read aloud as a science picture book.
Yes.
One that sounded beautiful, you know, that sort of feels good when it comes out of your mouth and feels great when it lands on the ear. And I also wanted something that reflected the mood of the giant squid or the mystery of the giant squid. Seeing Eric's illustrations, that really helped with the mood and the language, because the pictures are so writhing and mysterious and dark and odd and wonderful, that it felt the tone. I felt like he'd provided me with the tone of the book. And then I think I love what you said about the scientists, because that's exactly what I think both he and I were trying to do, was we were trying to mirror how scientists, for the most part, have learned about giant squid, have been from things that they have discovered that have washed up on shore, a tentacle, or there's a great story about a couple of kids that found an eye. I said, imagine that. And I on the beach in Australia. And, you know, I think when I talk about the book with kids, I say, so yeah, you find a big eye. What do? You pick it up, you take it home. They all go, no, no. Well, these kids like took it to an oceanographer who has it in a jar. So this is how scientists have actually had to learn about the squid. They've not gotten to see the squid in its natural habitat. Only now they've only caught a few minutes of it actually swimming in deep ocean. So this is how they've had to learn about it bit by bit. And so that book really reflects how scientists have unraveled the mystery to an extent that they've unraveled it, because the book actually, you know, I discovered that the book was full of a lot of rhetorical questions, because the creature really poses more questions than answers.
And there's the great sleight of hand with this book, with the text in this book, is that it does read beautifully like poetic writing, but nothing in it is fiction.
Oh, that's our dog dropped.
Sorry.
Yeah, dog dropped his phone at our feet.
Yeah. It's all nonfiction, so all the facts are correct. And I think what it does is it makes the reader become interested in the mystery.
Yes.
Makes the reader not just, I mean, oftentimes, and I read lots of them when I was a kid, I'd read a book about whales or something, and there were lots of answers. And some questions that you know, it drew out, but we know so little about the giant squid. When Candy was doing research, she used a particular book, one of Richard Ellis book about giant squid. And it's, I don't know, 250, 300 pages long. And there are 26 pages of facts. Everything else is supposition, mythology. He talks about how to make models of squid, but that's cool. All we have, you know.
But I love being able to bring that to the reader, to say, look, we don't know. You know, so often, and I think so often with nonfiction,
yeah,
we often
true.
Think it's for a report. So we're supposed to have a whole bunch of, you know, facts in there because that's what it's for. But, you know, that's not what I think nonfiction's about. So it's really about a really great reading experience. But also, I think nonfiction, at least in the 21st century, is meant to make readers think. And I think that's what giant squid does, if nothing else. Yeah, they want to say to themselves, I wonder, I wish I knew, who could I write about this? In fact, that's what I did. I wonder, I wish I knew, who could I write about this? I actually ended up writing Dr. Edith Witter, who's the woman that actually managed to get that very first little film clip of the giant squid underwater, and she probably is the foremost expert or one of them, and certainly is all up to date on her squids, you know, scholarship. And so she actually, she's unbelievably generous, and she actually vetted the manuscript when I was finished. So to make sure it's completely up to date.
And, Candy knew she was making a picture book. And when we talk about picture books, and I'm sure you would agree with this, that in a picture book, the parent, the all-knowing expert, should never be the one to solve the problem. And in a way, she wrote it so that we have experts, we have facts, but the person writing, and the kid reading realizes that there's all these questions, that the expert knows some things, but it's up to you. You're the next step. You're the next one who's going to be in the diving bell and go away.
I think that first off, I don't want to miss the opportunity to say, Candy, that I think you pull off this text so successfully. It's so beautiful. I love the way that you describe the poetry with the way the word feels in your mouth and the way it lands on your ear. Those are phrases that I use too, and it gives me goosebumps to
Oh
hear you say that. I love that. And I love as well in writing poetry as you do here and controlling the spaces, the indentations, and the way the text falls. I love that in that way you're orchestrating the way we read it, or the way that a child can pick up on
yeah,
how to
that's
read it.
exactly right.
And
Yeah,
it
we're
allows,
going for you to pause,
yes,
right?
it allows for movement, it allows for interpretation, and it's a beautiful dance then with, again, mimicking that movement of the squid, which is such a beautiful fluid movement when you watch video of them.
Thank you.
But
And
what.
what fun it is that you can have that, and then you can have the page turn. So you have
Oh,
this
yeah.
this you know this you're using every tool to guide the reader to the meaning of what you're trying to say.
Oh, until you get to that climax of the book when you've laid in there this beautiful gatefold where we get to hold or attempt to hold in our hands this giant squid, this illustration of this giant squid. I love the physical quality of the art just spilling out over your hands, holding a glimpse of this giant animal.
And we often talk about that. There's always the question of whether picture books can survive in the world of digital devices. And there are certain things that work better when you have a child holding
Of
the or
course.
when you have the librarian or the teacher or the parent or the sibling revealing it, like even that opening movement sort of opens your arms up, and so it mimics the opening of a curtain,
I
which
laugh
is
too
pretty
because
great.
I laugh because as a librarian, we know that sometimes the opening of a gatefold is a lot easier for a child than the closing of subsequent gatefold.
Did you notice the way the design of the gatefold is a it's a the outside flaps are, I think, an eighth of an inch
They're a
shorter.
little shorter, so we're not going to
Yeah,
catch those
just for that
corners.
exact
For
reason.
that very reason, thinking about
Exactly.
those little hands trying to put that gatefold
So
back.
we wouldn't end up with what you see often with a gatefold is they try to match it up, and unfortunately it doesn't always
I
survive.
feel like the only way the next technology will have to be somehow embedding within the pages a tiny strip of magnet just to help the kids, like, no, let it just line up on the magnet and then there we
That's
go.
amazing. Let it just snap back in.
Yeah.
Just let it
That's
snap
awesome.
back in.
That's really
Well,
good.
I wanted to say before we move past this book, though, that one of the neat things that Eric, you were saying something and it made me think of this. Because up until recently, we hadn't seen this full image of a squid. There was just pieces to guess at. That brought up in me so much that feeling of what it was like when we were discovering dinosaurs and how you get just pieces when you learn that in these museums, when you see, I live right outside of, or I live nearby Washington, D.C. So I've grown up getting to look at dinosaurs my whole life. But to know that when you see these skeletons that sometimes not even a half or even a quarter of those skeletons are real bones, that they're all just guesses at the bones. To know that works that way, and that for a long time, this giant squid worked that way too. We were guessing at what it might look like, and still there's things like there's great parallels, like what does a giant squid's color actually look like that you bring home, which is
And
a
here's
dinosaur
the
question
question.
too.
And with as far as the color goes, it There is a disagreement. I mean, one of the videos shows it as a silver color. Another video shows it silver and red. And then most of the squid we see near the surface are washed up, are red. And so there's some people who say it turns red when it's dying or when it's angry or when it's close to the surface where the water's more oxygenated. So that was a problem.
Well, and I even asked our experts, I asked both Dr. Witter, who said she believed silver. And then I asked Richard Ellis, the author of that great book about squid, and I think he's at the museum in New York, Richard Ellis.
Yeah, I'm not sure, yeah.
And he said red, and so you'll notice Eric's is sort of silverish red.
Yeah,
red. Cut it down the middle, yeah.
Isn't that what all this is? I mean, it's all in some ways supposition. A lot of the behavior that we know about giant squid is because it's a squid and we know about other squid.
Right.
So that was fun. As a person who wanted to get it accurate, that was a little anxiety provoking, but I realized that that's part of the, part of the mystery.
I love when anything, I feel like in life there's a positive quality to things being slightly anxiety provoking.
Yeah.
It does drive you forward, but hopefully,
yeah, it certainly does.
Hopefully there's a moment when you're able to go, okay, it's done. I'm not going to make any more touches to the book. We're going to walk away, back away slowly, and let children go and enjoy it.
And I think that's where that's the difference between a creator who's healthy, relatively healthy, and the opposite. And that's if you can make something and then make the corrections on the next piece instead of worrying about what the other ones were. Because both Candy and I have made things that maybe we, if it was a different world, we would take another shot at it. But I could honestly say we've probably not made the same mistakes twice.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, to go from talking about what's in the deep depths of the ocean, I feel like you're hitting all of my childhood like games and thoughts and wonderfulness that I've just carried into my adulthood.
I'm glad we could take you back.
No doubt. To go deep into the ocean. Oh, I'm still there, Eric. I'm still there.
Okay.
But to go deep into the ocean to, I think that's why I couldn't help but talk about dinosaurs tonight. And then to go into like perhaps the most well-known cowboy in our history. Candy, I would love to take a moment to talk about presenting Buffalo Bill, the man who invented the Wild West. Your another book with Neil Porter, your novel.
Mm-hmm. It's a biography. So
yeah.
It's all true.
And it reads wonderfully. And this is like, I was telling you before recording that to have the opportunity to glance through historical photos, I confess that as much as I've loved cowboys and as much as I've loved all of that, I think I never hit the point in my life when I went researching, probably because when I was younger, we didn't necessarily have access to all of those photos as easily as now we do.
Yeah, we can see them now. Yeah.
It was cool to go back though. So why talk about Buffalo Bill other than because it's awesome?
that's a Neil Porter idea in truth. Before I was doing even Eric's giant squid text, I've known Neil a long time, but we've never worked together. And we always claim that for the last 15 years, we've made eyes at each other, but we've never never done a project. And but we've always been friends. So one day I open up my email and there's an email from him with the subject line, Candy, want to do a book? He'd gone on to Cody, Wyoming, with some friends, had gone to the Buffalo Bill Museum and had become enamored with Buffalo Bill, and thought to himself, two things. One, he really would like a book on Buffalo Bill, and two, he hadn't seen a new one in a long time. And so he thought of me. And I'll be really honest, at first I thought to myself, oh, no, not Buffalo Bill. I didn't think I'm remotely interested in him. You think about all those sort of dusty old myths and tropes from the American West. And I think this isn't probably my guy, but it is Neil. And so I'm going to do him the favor of, instead of rejecting his idea out of hand, I'm going to go and read Will Cody's autobiography.
Yes.
And when I got done reading that biography, I was hooked because the guy could tell a story. Now, he didn't know how to tell a true story, but he sure could tell a story. And I was left, like I always do when I end up deciding that I have to do a book about somebody, that I'm going to now spend, you know, 3-4 years on somebody's life. I have to be absolutely, like, beguiled and completely curious. I have so many questions and I need those answers. And so that's how it started. But what I discovered most interesting, besides the fact that he's got this, like, you know, despite his lies, he's got a pretty amazing life. But it's a real controversial life. With American Indians, you know, were they exploited? Were they not? The history of you know, the U.S. government and how terrible they treated American Indians all becomes part of that Wild West story or Buffalo Bill story. But what I thought was most fascinating, and, you know, you probably noticed really the theme of the book, is the fact that we think of him as this old guy, you know, why even bother to know about him anymore? But in truth, Buffalo Bill is a part of every single one of us. And we don't even know it. We carry him around because if you ask people, you know, give me your first idea of the American West, they'll say, oh, stagecoaches, you know, forming a circle to protect themselves against American Indian attack, which never, ever happened in history. But it happened every night at the Wild West show for 30 years. The same thing with the cavalry racing in with that, you know, clarion call of the bugle and they race in to save somebody.
Yes.
That never happened in history either, except the Wild West did it, performed it every night for 30 years. Or even the idea of the cowboy. You know, he's our American hero. He's our myth. But that was created by Will Cody. It's straight up Will Cody. He's the one that puts the Stetson hat on him. He's the one that cleans them up because they were sort of, they didn't have a good reputation. They were sort of bad guys until the Wild West came along and he, you know, sort of shone a light on their abilities, their roping tricks and their riding tricks, cleaned them up, made them say, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. The whole idea of them ballad singing, crooning across the plains. That is not true, except that people saw it in the Wild West for 30 years, all around the world. And what he did was create American memory. People thought they were seeing the very last true show, and he always told people it was a true reenactment of everything. So they believed they were seeing the very last of the Wild West, just as it was disappearing from our American history anyway. They believed they were seeing the last of it. And so they bought his memory. So he really formed America's collective memory. And that memory has been passed down now for 100 years. And it's still going strong, you know? And I think that's just absolutely fascinating. You know?
Yes, that's what I walked away with too. The idea that this one guy really informed, I mean, you could see that. I knew about Buffalo Bill because that was a name that you just know. You just know Buffalo, like you grow up and you just know that he's a famous cowboy. But to know that, to really read that, I'm only halfway through the story, but to read that that our history is really our memory, our shows, our everything. The way that the way that cowboys are glorified, the reason why people still on Halloween like want to be a cowboy is they want to be Buffalo Bill. You don't want to be a cowboy. You want to be Buffalo Bill.
Yeah, well, at least Buffalo Bill's version of the cowboy, because they wouldn't want to be a real cowboy. Those guys were not so great.
And visually, there's a straight line between Buffalo Bill's imagery and then Russell and Remington.
Well, Remington did a lot of the Wild West posters. And some of his own work is not based necessarily on guys that he saw out in the West, but guys that he saw at the Wild West.
And then from Remington comes John Ford, and then from John Ford comes what we, you know, the 1950s cowboy, and I suppose the latest incarnation is Woody from Toy Story.
Yeah, there you go.
So he comes straight out of the Wild West.
That's just amazing. And
Yeah.
it's a cool story. And I feel like then the way that you, this is your writing style though. This is how we know you. But the way that you drop us into the story in the beginning, I was hooked so fast because to start off your introduction, your whatever it was, your the beginning, yeah. your foreword, whatever it was. The story about the queen, that we start off with his cavalcade of like hundreds of people that he traveled with, and buffalo, right. and bears, and my
bears,
word.
Buffalo, log cabins. Yeah,
and like he built a log cabin. Yes, the things. Yeah. Where I was like, this did this really happen? Not, you know, 3 years ago. Who travels like that? How did that happen? And then to see that it was, yeah, not just that you were like setting this up and performing this thing, but you were going across the ocean to do this. It was mind-blowing that happened.
Yeah, special performance for the queen. It was important, though, because I thought, I don't think my readers, they're going to know who, I love how all readers are my readers. You like how I just take them all.
my
take
readers.
They're my readers. But I didn't think they would know who he was, and I didn't think they would know what the show was. So that's the reason to start right there with the show so they could see it. And it's also the reason that every chapter starts with another, another performance from the show, another act
yes.
from the show. This is the very same reason. And why it's in present tense is that I wanted those readers to feel like they were sitting there in the stands participating, seeing it. I needed them to understand how enamored audiences around the world were with that show, because it was important to show just how much that show meant to people, because that's how that memory that we were talking about earlier actually, you know, grew, how it's been sustained. So, yeah. Of course, then you have Bill's great stories, which when I was writing, I've struggled for a very long time because I thought, how in the world do I stop in the middle of his great story, like writing the Pony Express? how do I stop that great story in the middle and say, you know, well, let's stop a minute and you know, this part, it probably wasn't true. It just felt really intrusive, and it just wasn't fun.
Yes.
The reading wouldn't have been any fun. So I let them tell his tale. Yeah, let them have their fun. So then I let them tell the tale, let him tell his tale. But then I have those little sections called Panning for Nuggets of Truth, where I kind of step in as an author and say, let's look at the rest of the historical evidence. Let's look at some of the historical record, some things beyond Bill Cody's own autobiography, and let's see if we can figure out if this is truth or maybe not so much truth. I know when I talk to kids, especially older grades, fourth, fifth, sixth graders and up, they tell me that that autobiography was a primary source, and they've been told that primary source is the best source.
It's the best source.
Yeah, it's the best source. And I think to myself, well, let's take a look at that again. It's a good source, but maybe not necessarily the most truthful source. But I love that. And at the end, I never bothered to. I mean, I don't tell my readers if it's true or not. I have a definite opinion about if Buffalo Bill rode the Pony Express. I don't think he did, and most historians don't. But there are some still out there that do. And there are some shreds of evidence that would point to the fact that he did. And so I don't think it's my call to tell readers if he does or if he did or did it. I'm just going to present the evidence and let them decide. It's what my friend Tanya Bolden calls kicking it to the reader.
To
the reader. Once again, asking the reader to think. You know, you do the thinking, you decide. You know?
Yeah, well, to be in a position where it's, where we are so captivated by his stories, and we are, it makes me think of, this wouldn't be anything that the kids could reference or draw reference from, but you both could if you've seen it. Tim Burton directed a movie a couple of years back called Big Fish about this guy, this father who always told these giant stories and could these things really have possibly happened? And he's on his deathbed and his son is sort of going to find out whether or not anything's true. And one of the big messages of that story is like, would you really want to know? Don't you, in some places, having a little bit of mystery and legend there is sort of wonderful. It's sort of what preserves things forever.
I agree. Let them have their yarn, you know?
Yeah, there you
And
go.
unless the true story changes your life, let the story stand because that will change your life.
Yes. Man. Okay, I can't think of a better way to end on that conversation.
That
Holy cow, knock
was
me off my feet. It's been such a great pleasure to talk to you both. Thank you, Candy. Thank you, Eric, for
Well,
putting
this
time
is
aside.
so much fun. Thank you. You're very insightful, and it's thrilling for us on this end that we do a book and you and your readers are getting it.
It's a great treat. And then, am I correct then in assuming, Candy, because I was picking that up when you were sharing it, that these are both your first times working with Neil?
It is my
It
first
is.
time. It just happened to land on the
On the
same.
same time, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's
Yeah.
great. Congratulations for that.
Right?
We were
I've
talking
worked with
before
Rory
recording.
for a long time, but this is
Yeah.
the first time with Neil. Yeah.
But it won't be our last. We're working on our new book now. Well, I'm on our new book now.
Well, I'm a fan of Neil Porter, and
Me
for
too.
to know that there's stuff coming, and it's just wonderful. You've written two beautiful books, Candy, really masterfully. And my word, Giant Squid, keep doing poetry that way. It was so effective and so beautiful. And Eric, your art, the way you do this, is something that I think plays such a beautiful movie in the eyes of the reader. So, job well done.
Thank you. Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you.
All right, before I let you both go, I'm going to ask you this one final question. And Eric, I'm going to start with you, and then we'll turn to Candy. I'm going to see a library full of children, as you know, tomorrow morning. What message would you like for me to bring to them from you, Eric?
That's sort of I mean, it's one of those questions that has these multiple answers, and so many of the answers are sort of enormous. The great thing about what we do is that our audience doesn't really just read or listen. They actually inhabit the things that we make. They crawl inside, mentally crawl inside them. So I guess what I would tell them is let it wash over you, and what happens next? If there was another page, what would you do with that page? Or if it was your job to write the next book, what would that book be?
Wonderful. And Candy, I'll ask you the same question. What message would
Oh.
you like for me to bring to them from you?
Oh, mine is going to just be really simple because yours was so good, Eric.
Well, every once in a
I
while.
know. So I'm just going to tell them to marvel, to wonder at things, and when Mr. Winter reads out loud, to dance to those words.
Podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with books that they'll love. And the Best Book Ever This Week podcast, hosted by me, with book reviews about all sorts of amazing books. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referred to. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment at allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing this podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Box Brown talks about making comics. Specifically, Tetris, The Games We Play, his newest graphic novel. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.